10 more were injured. From the wreckage of the Candle Bay facility, we pulled a further 15 corpses. Guards, alchemists, prisoners, clerical staff. Prisoners escaped by the score, and many of them had been imprisoned for crimes greater than your father's. Now we have murderers, rapists, dangerous soulbound, and black alchemists walking the streets of the capital, thanks to your actions. There was no anger in the Emperor's voice, but there was enough sheer force to drive Calder down into the ground. His ancient intent made the air thicker than swamp water. Under normal circumstances, Calder would have done whatever the Emperor commanded him, bound by such pressure. He would have likely wet himself. But today, he carried some anger of his own. I witnessed 5 men and women gladly fall to their deaths on the rocks of Candle Bay. I don't know what experiments your alchemists ran on my father, but he begged me to push him out of a window. My father, Roderick Martin. He carried such pain with him that I could feel it pouring from him like heat from a bonfire. He tried to strangle himself with his bedsheets, to shatter the window with his chair so that he could leap from his cell, and he was imprisoned for stealing a pen! By the end of the speech, Calder was on his feet and shouting at the ruler of the Aurelian Empire, a ruler who seemed more interested in idly flipping a coin than in the fate of Calder's father. If the Emperor was moved, offended, or provoked by Calder's passion, he showed nothing. He did not just steal a pen, Calder, as you know better than most. He stole my pen. I knew a man who killed 32 innocent people with a knife that I had used once to spread butter. When I use an object, even for the briefest period, it is cleansed by the Luminians and then incinerated. But over time, inevitably some fragment of refuse evades our notice and escapes. The Emperor waved his hand. We are not here to discuss your father's crimes. We're here to discuss yours. Standing was awkward in this room of featureless stone, but Calder refused to kneel again. He walked over to a pillar and sat, leaning his back against the base of the stone column.
Candle Bay was a house of torture, he said. It was better off destroyed.
He believed that. He had to believe that, or else confront the fact that he had been responsible for the deaths of 20 real, live, breathing men and women.
Despite what you may believe, my guild of alchemists is not on trial today either. However, there is another guild involved.
He tossed the coin from one hand to the other.
Tell me, Calder Martin, what do you know about the Navigators?
This abrupt shift in subject took Calder by surprise. He had only ever met one navigator, and he suspected Cheska Bennett was not a representative sample of her guild.
Very little.
You know that they are the only ones who can safely cross the Aeon. I founded them for that purpose. What do you think makes their ships able to navigate those waters? Superior carpentry.
I don't
think, boy.
The intent behind the command was enough to make the room seem to shake, and Calder rattled his brain, trying to shake something loose.
It must have to do with reading, somehow. The ships are invested in a particular way, treated with a blend of alchemy.
The Emperor tapped the edge of his coin against the throne, waiting for him to continue.
They must navigate differently from ordinary sailors in some way, hence the name. Invested navigational equipment?
The Emperor leaned forward.
They have guides.
The puzzle came apart in Calder's mind. Of course, the navigators had to be guided through the threats of the Aeon, which were often caused by elders. That was what the Black Watch had been trying to do with the Testament, summon a bigger, stronger guide.
Elders, he answered. They have elders bound to their ships.
Only one ship has that distinction. The others simply have the power of an elder bound into their ship through bone or blood or a particular artifact. Then the ships themselves are awakened, bound to their captains. Soul-bound.
Calder's breath caught. Soul-bound were the greatest warriors of the Empire, possessing powers that came from the pinnacle of reading. It was from them that the truly miraculous feats of history had come. Esther Six flying over the ranks of 1,000 Elderspawn to reach Ophagor.
Baldassar Kern destroying the armies of the South Sea Revolution, they could call on the seemingly magical powers of Chimera as long as they held their vessel.
Me? Is that what I did?
The Blackwatch ship known as the Testament is now your soul-bound vessel, Calder Martin. We didn't need to tow it back. The Lyathaton dragged it into the nearby harbor on its own.
The Emperor leaned back in his throne.
That's why you have not been executed already.
Involuntarily, Calder's hand went to his throat.
You're surprised. How else did you think I would deal with someone who committed thousands of gold marks of property damage, murdered 20 citizens, and stole a priceless ship? You deserve execution, if anyone in my empire does.
A small candle flame of hope lit in Calder's chest.
But you won't execute me.
I will turn you over to the custody of the Navigators Guild, who will put you to work in my service until your debt to me is cleared. Your bonds and responsibilities to the Black Watch are hereby abolished.
Calder couldn't help the smile that started to spread across his face.
Your mercy is as limitless as the breadth of your rule, my Emperor.
The Emperor did not smile.
Bring in the prisoner.
Doors opened at the end of the hall, and two Imperial guards marched Roderick Martin inside. He was gagged, his prison suit rumpled, his hair matted with sweat. When he caught sight of Calder, he struggled forward to try and reach his son. But one of the guards had an arm that looked as though it was sheathed in steel. Roderick might as well have been anchored in place. The other, whose eyes glowed a solid red, bowed before the Emperor. From his throne, the ruler of the Aurelian Empire looked at no one but Calder.
I told you to beware of deals that seem too favorable. I do not reward criminals, not even when circumstances force me to.
The Emperor tossed something at Calder's feet, something that clinked and rang like a tiny bell. The silver coin. But now it was warped and deformed, as if under great pressure.
Geralis, the Emperor said.
The general stepped forward, pulling her sword out from behind her back. Its blade was rough-forged black iron, with a core of some substance that flowed a bright, glowing red down the center of the metal. Calder hardly saw it. His senses were overwhelmed. The smell of ash and rot, the taste of blood in his mouth, the screams of the dying, the desperately lonely fear that comes from a nightmare. All of it blasted out from the sword in a silent wind. The Emperor stood.
Roderick Martin, citizen of my empire, I sentence you to die.
Roderick strained against his captors, pushing away, trying to escape, his eyes locked with Calder's. Geralis Teach brushed Roderick's shoulder with the flat of her blade. That done, she returned her weapon to its sheath. That was all it took. With an audible shriek that emanated from nowhere and seemed to tear the world in half, the life left Roderick Martin's body. He sagged, his eyes suddenly glassy. The two Imperial guards withdrew, dragging Roderick's body behind them. Through his tears, Calder screamed. He shouted at the Emperor, at Geralis Teach, at himself. He surged forward, focused on tearing the Emperor's flesh with his bare hands.
He's a man, Calder shouted to himself. Just a man, like me, like my father. He will die like one.
Geralis Teach didn't bother with him, returning to her post behind the throne. Instead, he was tackled by three black-clad shadows. A blonde girl held a bronze knife to Calder's throat, while a Heartlander boy about his age held his arms locked behind his back. A pale, black-haired girl, perhaps a year or two younger than he, stood in front of him, hands empty and spread in front of her.
Relax, she said soothingly.
The boy spoke over his shoulder.
Release your intent.
Calder could feel the other boy's intent smothering his own, countering the rage and lethal intent that Calder was pouring into everything, into the stone at his feet, into every fiber of his clothes, into the weapons of these three children who dared to stop him. But the other boy, the other reader, was canceling it all out, smoothing the hostility like a maid smoothing sheets. The black-haired girl yawned and scratched the back of her neck with a dagger.
Did you know that man? He was my father,
Calder shouted. She shrugged.
Then he'd want you to be quiet so we don't kill you.
Calder glared at the Emperor, desperate to hurt the man somehow, even in the smallest way.
You keep children around to protect you?
As I said, you are all children to me.
The Emperor rummaged through his pockets, pulled out a gold coin, and flipped it.
Besides, they need their exercise. Return to your ship, Calder Martin. You and your vessel are now property of the Aurelian Empire.
The three black-clad children vanished, the dark-haired girl yawning as she scurried off. How did they disappear so quickly? Except for the occasional pillar, the chamber was nothing but empty, open space. As Calder was dragged away by the guard with the metal arm, he took one last look at the Emperor, sitting on his throne and idly toying with his gold coin. Another set of prisoners was being dragged inside.
The only one who can change the Empire is sitting on that throne, he thought. So far removed from humanity that he might as well be Elderspawn himself.
Clarity hit him like a shaft of blinding light.
As Sedesthenes once said, nothing lasts forever.
Chapter 27. Present Day. The dome of earth rose away from the vast underground chamber, lifted by the bony hands and swarming tentacles of Nekothi's handmaiden. The roof over the arena was hundreds of yards across, and when the titanic elder tore it away, it looked like she was tearing an island in half. Clods of dirt and chunks of rock big enough to crush horses rained down all over the arena. The three consultants scrambled out of the way, helping each other to shelter. Calder's first instinct told him to join them, but he had a more important task.
Ursaya.
The soulbound warrior still lay on his back only feet away, staring up at the suddenly bare sky. Calder edged closer, ignoring the ground shuddering under repeated impacts. His first view of Urzaya told him that the situation was hopeless. He was covered in injuries, but none compared to the hole in his chest, which oozed blood and throbbed as though his heart were trying to escape. He stared sightlessly as clouds of dirt fell into his open eyes.
Captain,
he said, just as Calder had convinced himself the man was already dead. Calder fell to his knees, ignoring the pain in his leg and fighting down a sudden hope. Maybe he could still be saved. But no, he could sense the residual intent that Shara's awakened blade had left behind. It stole the power Urzaya had drawn from his vessel, turning it against his body. Calder couldn't imagine how the man had held on this long.
I'm with you, Urzaya. We'll see you fixed up and back on duty before next week.
The gladiator choked out a laugh.
Still undefeated?
He wanted to let it go, just to comfort the man until the end, but these were the last words of a friend. He owed it to Urzaya to understand.
What do you mean? I got her, Captain. They took Jerry, so I took...
He gasped in pain, then set his mouth into a grin.
One of them. Maya. Her name was Maya. I took her with me.
Calder looked over to the shelter where the three consultants huddled together. Shara kept an eye on him, working her awakened knife in her hands, but Lucan was binding the blonde consultant's, Maya's, shoulder. She didn't look like a woman about to die. She looked angry.
They won't be able to replace her, Calder said gently. The consultants won't recover from this so easily. You've done me proud, Urzaya Woodsman.
Urzaya laughed again, more weakly.
I told you, never lost a fight in the arena. Not one.
Calder knelt at his cook's side, listening to the handmaiden howling above him. Kelerak's gift, the mark on his arm, let him feel the intent behind her fury. She sought the presence of something new, something deadly, something that posed a threat to her. She was waiting for reinforcements before she faced it. He remained absolutely still until Urzaya stopped breathing. It didn't take long. Then he scooped up Urzaya's awakened hatchets, shoving them into his belt.
He tried to minimize contact with the weapons, but a vision bubbled up unbidden. Raziah hefts his hatchets, watching the five enemies surround him. Not a soul bound among them. This is just a warm-up match to get the crowd in the mood. He mourns them already, but he can't allow himself to die here.
End this quickly, he silently begs his weapons. For them, there will be no pain.
Calder cut off the vision before the grief and rage drowned out his reason. With the hatchet secure, he walked over to the consultants. Children of Nakothi surrounded them, guided by the call of the handmaiden, waiting for their opportune moment to strike. Good. It just so happened that he needed to kill something. The other two stared at him suspiciously, but Shara rose to meet him, her face devoid of any human expression. Not that he expected anything else. It seems we have a common enemy, Calder said. He didn't bother to hide the bitterness in his expression or his voice. Shara didn't react, but she didn't stab him, which he took to mean she agreed. He pointed to her shining, shifting green blade. Can you kill it? He wanted to do it himself, but Kelerak had specifically cautioned him against using the blade against the handmaiden. He'd prefer to risk Shara's life than his own anyway. Shara turned to Lucan, who nodded.
If we can get you close enough, he said.
Calder rubbed absently at the burning mark on his right forearm, looking up at the handmaiden. He realized he was looking into her face, and his entire body shivered as he jerked away. It seemed less like a physical appendage and more like a nightmare made flesh. It's planning on attacking soon. When it does, I'll hit it as hard as I can. You'll have to find your own opening. To Calder's surprise, Shara's expression cracked. Instead of a passionless killer, he saw a weary woman ready to be done with a job.
What are the odds it will stay dead?
Based on my experience with the elders, abandon that hope. Her shoulders slumped and she rubbed at her face with one hand like a child up past her bedtime.
Maybe if I get wounded, they'll give me some time off. Maya stabbed me in the back.
Their other partner, Maya, was turning pale. She leaned the back of her head against the wall of the shed, panting and holding on to her bandaged wound. Disturbing shapes twisted and moved underneath her skin. She didn't seem likely to rise to the bait. Lucan patted Shara on the shoulder, consoling her.
Don't worry, I'm sure she would stab you if she could.
These were the ruthless assassins who had pursued him since he'd left the capital? They acted like, well, like his crew. For some reason, the thought seethed with anger. What right did they have to joke with each other? They could kill his friend and still play around? Just do your part, he said roughly, and walked a short distance away. With his newfound sensitivity to elders, thanks to Kelerak's mark, he reached out his intent, seeking out one elder spawn in particular. A simple, unfathomable alien mind. A bellowing horror. Shuffles, he yelled. A familiar silhouette flapped up on top of a half-collapsed stone column, tentacles writhing over its mouth. Calder spoke directly to his pet elder spawn, backing up his words with intent to reinforce their meaning. I need you to repeat everything I say as loud as you can. Do you understand? We need to reach the testament.
Testament!
Shuffles bellowed, and the entire cavern echoed with the force of his roar. Strangely, though Calder was standing next to it, Shuffle's volume didn't sound much greater than normal. By rights, a shout powerful enough to reach the testament should have shattered Calder's eardrums. But he only knew it was louder than normal because of the way the dust vibrated all over the chamber, echoing from the walls. Whatever the reason, he was grateful for it. Maybe he wouldn't go deaf today. Foster, Calder said.
Foster!
Ready cannons!
Ready cannons!
Calder paused for a moment, giving Foster time to comply. Though the entire Gray Island seemed to shake under Shuffle's announcement, he had no idea whether the gunner heard him. At this distance, he could barely sense his vessel's location. He had no chance of controlling the ship directly. And though Kelerak had enhanced his ability to communicate with the Leviathan, the elder creature couldn't load and fire a cannon. The handmaiden heard his words and must have understood because her intent sharpened. Her pale tentacles, covered in hands, slithered closer, and she shrieked, pointing at him with one finger. All the children of Nakothi on the island swarmed down into the shattered arena, hungering for his blood. They sought Shara's blade more than anything else, but now they would dismantle him on the way. He turned back to Shuffles, and he couldn't help a smile.
Jerry would love this.
Take aim!
Aim!
He waited a moment longer, forcing himself to stare the handmaiden in the face. He began to tear up, his eyes trying to force themselves away from the sight as a purely physical reaction, but he kept looking. He wanted to see this. Fire!
Fire!
The announcement echoed from every corner of the island. An instant later, missiles slammed into the handmaiden's chest, sending up geysers of white blood. Seconds after that, the sound caught up, every available cannon on the testament cracking at once. Calder grinned straight up at the elder's unfathomable face and shouted again,
"Fire! Fire!"
A few seconds of delay, and two cannonballs crashed into the handmaiden's ribs, and a third snapped a tree in half. That was all he had time to witness before Nakothi's children struck him like a cresting wave. He devoted himself to reading the flow of hostile intent, lunging and dipping and dodging as he swept his cutlass through each of the dead elder spawn. Only one strike for each. He kept limping along as he fought, Shuffles flapping along behind him, occasionally shouting the order to fire. Sword first, he worked his way up the staircase. He wished Shara the very best of luck, but he wasn't going to stick around to see how the fight turned out. If his fortune had turned for the better, the handmaiden and the consultants would kill each other. Meanwhile, he had a date to keep. Jerry pushed her way back against the wall as the bone-clawed crab, one of Nakothi's children, snapped and slobbered through the bars of her cell. It strained its claw, reaching for her and falling well short. It stood in a red mess, what was left of another prisoner who had fled from deeper in the complex. Apparently, there were more cells deeper within that Jerry had never seen, and some of their occupants had tried to make a break for it. This one had run into an elder spawn and been pulled to pieces for his trouble.
Mindless minions, useless.
What good was an elder with no wisdom? Nakothi was one great elder that Jerry wouldn't mind staying asleep forever. The bars squealed under the child's assault, and Jerry pressed herself further against the stone. She was distracting herself. She could admit that. She just didn't want to confront the fact that in a few seconds, the bars would fold, and then she would end up just like the other prisoner. A puddle of red meat and cloth. She shouted for help again, but of course anyone left alive in these tunnels would be locked in a cell, just like her. If only she had her vessel, she could protect herself. If only. But wishes hadn't freed her during her incarceration, and they wouldn't protect her now. The crab raised up a spindly, misshapen leg that looked like it was made of nothing but skin stretched over bone. The leg wriggled in between the door, working at the twisted lock, and the abused, weakened metal finally snapped. With a groan, the door to Jerry's cell folded open. She forced a crazy grin, raising her fists. Whenever she'd imagined her own death, she'd pictured herself going down fighting. Well, this wouldn't be much of a fight, but she'd take her best shot. The corpse crab hissed in glee, scrabbling over the stone to get closer. It moved with the eagerness of a dog suddenly unleashed, bolting for its first meal in days.
"You're late, Calder," Jerry thought.
Then the stone at her back grew much, much colder. She almost staggered backwards as the wall behind her disappeared, but she managed to stop herself at the feeling of her heels moving out over empty air. She was standing at the very edge of a cliff.
"Avoid transmission, now?"
Whatever the Cabal was going to do, they had best do it quickly. A single piece of jewelry tumbled through the air, gleaming green and gold. She recognized it instantly, just as she felt her own limbs. This close, she didn't need to touch it to call on its powers. She'd been reaching for it mentally for days, but she caught it nonetheless. The fury of her vessel filled her, and she lashed out with a blade of emerald fire. The crab's body divided into two smoking halves, each sliding around her and vanishing into the void. Jerry gripped the earring with so much force she was almost afraid she'd crush it, fist shivering with relief. After weeks of waiting and wondering, she was finally whole. The voice from the void, this time, was multi-layered and female, like three sisters trying to speak over one another.
"We have made you wait. We apologize. The summoning did not go as we expected." "You're here now,"
Jerry said. She couldn't help a surge of joy. Being separated from her vessel was like losing her arms and legs. She stuck the earring through her right ear, sighing in satisfaction.
"Our plans have fallen apart," the voices said. "Yet we have succeeded in unexpected ways. Now we must make new plans."
Jerry started to walk toward the bars, slashing them into two red-hot halves that quickly cooled.
"Contact me when the testament docks." "Negative. Your transportation is being prepared."
Jerry turned, surprised. The sleepless cabal had never objected to her going where she wanted before. In the swimming lights and endless black of the void, an elder spawn floated. It looked like an octopus, tendrils swimming in unseen water, but its head was smooth and flat. Was she supposed to ride on that? Jerry didn't sense any hostility from it, or intelligence of any kind, but she still hesitated. She wasn't so comfortable with the void that she wanted to ride into it on the back of an unknown creature. The ceiling creaked above her, and she stepped to the side just in time to avoid a waterfall of rock dust.
"This structure is unstable,"
the voices said.
"This is the safest way out."
Jerry still hesitated.
"I want your word that you will release me. I have personal business to attend to. If you leave any other way, you will die. Give me your word, or I walk out of this cell."
She had no doubt they were telling the truth about the unstable structure, but the Cabal couldn't predict the future. Only Akhmagut could do that. She would take her chances with a crumbling building if she had to.
"Our word is granted,"
the mysterious voice said. Hesitantly, Jerry walked up to the edge of the void. She glanced down and immediately wished she hadn't. It was as though the world ended at the back of her prison cell. Colored lights and darkness swirled around at every angle. The Elderspawn platform drifted closer, anchoring to the stone edge of the cell with its suction cups.
"Time is short,"
the disembodied voice whispered. After one more instant of hesitation, Jerry stepped out onto the creature's flattened head.
"Wait for me, Calder. I'll sort this out."
She'd left just in time. Behind her, through the shrinking void portal, she saw the roof of the prison crumble.
"We told you,"
the voices said, smug. Calder reached the hidden door to the prisons just as the ground caved in, like a suddenly collapsing sinkhole.
"No," he thought. "No, it's not possible."
He had agonized for so long about whether to save Jerry or not, and here he had arrived 5 seconds too late. Calder jerked the door open, hobbling down the staircase on his wounded leg. The first part of the tunnel was surprisingly whole, giving him some hope. The whole island was riddled with tunnels and underground chambers, after all. Maybe a different part of the network had collapsed. When he reached the bottom of the stairs, he could see clearly that the end of the tunnel was choked with debris, but the cells on his left were surprisingly clear. Sure, Lucan's cell was covered in rocks and dust, but the door had swung open. It was nothing that would pose a threat to anyone. Cautiously, afraid to brush against the wall lest he cause another cave-in, he edged to the next cell. A pile of blood, bars sliced in half, and a cell filled with rocks. For a moment, Calder's mind stopped working. This didn't make sense. Why didn't Jerry's cell look like Lucan's? His was almost untouched, it was just a little dusty. This one was only next door. Why was it so much worse? I was too late. After all that, too late. The thought tore at his sanity, pulling at the stitching that held him together. But only a few seconds later, his reasoning reasserted itself. He didn't know anything, and someone had cut these bars. The collapsing tunnel hadn't done that. Calder reached out a hand, afraid to touch the blood and flesh. He didn't want to conjure a vision of a violent death, but he had to know if it was Jerry. The reading was vague, as the death hadn't occurred long ago. There was very little intent clinging to the remains, and none in the surrounding rocks. But he sensed panic, and fear, and finally desperation, along with a familiar, mindless hunger. The children of Nakothi had been here. He reached his hand farther into the cell, seeking a vision, probing for Jerry's presence. Jerry looks at the child trying to force its way into the cell. Joy surges in her chest as she finally feels complete for the first time in weeks. She needs to break open a hole between her cell and Lucan's. The transport doesn't look reliable, but she's determined to live. He was getting brief flashes of intent, a few fractured visions, but they were all broken, weak, out of sequence. If he could only learn a little more. A crack ran down the wall behind him, and he grimaced to himself. He was out of time. All he knew for sure was that Jerry had made it out of the cell, one way or another. He turned away from the rubble-filled hallway and almost lost his head. A bronze blade flashed at his neck, and only years of training let him bend backwards, narrowly missing the edge on the skin of his throat. The blonde consultant, Maya, panted as she leaned with one hand against the wall.
"You will not escape," she panted.
Her skin was pale, her face covered in scrapes and cuts, her body trembling. She looked worse than Urziah had when he died. At that thought, Calder steeled his resolve and drew his sword.
"You should have checked behind you," he said.
She didn't blink, her eyes hardening. Then Shuffles flapped up behind the consultant.
"Behind you," he declared,
tentacles waving. Maya spun on the elder spawn, but she was too slow. Calder clubbed her on the back of the head with the hilt of his sword. She didn't lose consciousness, not entirely, but she did collapse. That was good enough for him. Andal had warned against clubbing people on the head less than an hour ago, but if she was tough enough to survive fighting a champion hand to hand, she could survive this. And if she couldn't, he wouldn't lose a minute of sleep over it. He confiscated her two obvious knives, the bronze ones she kept buckled to her back, and stuffed them into his belt next to Urziah's hatchets. Maya struggled weakly as he tossed her over his shoulder, just as Andal had carried Nabarius. The wound in his chest screamed in pain, but he was getting used to ignoring agonizing injuries, just as he was getting used to holding captives. At this rate, he would soon have more prisoners on the Testament than crewmen.
Shara's not the only one who can take hostages.
Taking Maya wasn't the best idea he could have come up with, but he was more comfortable improvising. It was likely the years of practice. But he couldn't help thinking, as he carried Maya and Shuffles back to the Testament, that he might be making a mistake. Chapter 28. Are all seven of the known great elders malicious? I do not think so. I think that most elders think of themselves as benefactors. Their ways are simply so alien, so absolutely incompatible with humanity, that the kindness of the great elders will very likely kill us all. Nakothi seems to believe, in her way, that she is improving humans by warping their bodies into the monstrous children. Kathanikar cares not for humanity, but he is interested in preserving this planet as a habitat for his worms. Urgnaut works for peace, as he sees it, the true peace of non-existence. Tharlos prefers a world of constant, endless change. Othagor wants, above all, to preserve life. Akhmagut seeks knowledge at all costs. Kalarak could say that he grants wishes. Archer Belfry, Imperial Witness, concluding his confidential report to the Black Watch. 11 years ago. Bliss stood on the top branches of the leafless tree, peering out of her greenhouse. From a vantage point like this, she could see the capital spreading out all around her, ancient spires and gleaming clock towers rising like fresh shoots from the soil of shingled townhouses. With a view like this, she could almost forget that she was surrounded by walls of glass. The spear of Tharlos squirmed within her coat, knocking against the fabric like a fist against an oak door. It didn't speak to her, not today, but she understood its pleas nonetheless. It thought those towers should be volcanoes, the clocks should be filled with muscle and skin instead of cogs and gears, and the townhouses should be solid blocks of ice. Tharlos was far too predictable. He always wanted everything to change. So boring. So what if he turned all shoes into ducks? If shoes were constantly turning into other things, then it wouldn't be anything special when they eventually started quacking. No one would notice. Change was only interesting when it was unexpected, and Tharlos could never understand that.
That's why he would never beat her. The image struck her again of people walking around with ducks strapped to their feet, and she almost giggled. She thought about giggling. She imagined herself letting loose a nice, girlish giggle, and that was just as good as the real thing. A gust of wind picked up the end of her white blonde hair, drawing it behind her like a streamer, and it took her a few seconds to understand why that was odd.
There's not supposed to be any wind in a greenhouse, she reminded herself. Wait, is there? No, definitely not.
She smacked the spear of Tharlos through her coat. It must have been up to its tricks again, making her see things that weren't actually happening. But for once, the spear felt quiet. She must be sensing something herself, and this was her unconscious mind's way of warning her consciousness. Or was it? She didn't know, but she hopped down into the tree nonetheless, swinging down from branch to branch until she could drop to the soil. Something was coming, and she'd rather face it up close. It might be interesting. The doors swung open, and a pair of watchmen walked in, escorting Ulsa Greyweather. They didn't look happy about it, but neither of them appeared quite so miserable as Ulsa. Her face was gray, her hands tied in front of her, and her eyes were red and puffy. That meant that she had been crying, or that she hadn't gotten much sleep, or that someone had sprayed an irritant in her eyes, or she had imbibed any number of alchemical substances which could be either harmful or recreational. After a moment's consideration, Bliss decided that weeping or exhaustion were the two most likely possibilities.
Are you under arrest, Ulsa?
Bliss asked, before one of the other watchmen could say something useless. Ulsa tried to speak, cleared her throat, and tried again.
My son had his trial this morning. As a result, my former husband was executed. Calder was exiled to the Aeon under the supervision of the Navigators, and I was remanded to your custody.
Bliss tried to fit Ulsa's story together with her memories, but found too many pieces missing.
A trial? Calder Martin? What did he do?
Ulsa's eyes widened.
An expression of surprise, or shock, or fear, or anger. Probably surprise. I'm sorry, Guildhead. I thought you would have been informed.
One of the watchmen stepped forward.
Guildhead, we've left several messages.
She stared at him until he fell silent.
He broke his father out of prison,
Ulsa said wearily.
In the process, he stole the ship we were preparing for the Navigators Guild, binding himself to it as his vessel. And the prison itself sustained irreparable damage. Many of the prisoners have not been recovered. Which prison?
Bliss asked. From what Bliss had observed of typical conversation, her question must have seemed out of context, but Ulsa answered immediately.
Candle Bay Imperial Prison.
That was why Bliss liked Ulsa. No matter what else changed, Ulsa Greyweather still did what she was supposed to. She was a constant.
Candle Bay Imperial Prison,
Bliss repeated. She knew the place. She knew what happened there. Canatalia, the Guild of Alchemists, performed experiments on the inmates of many imperial prisons, especially those who had committed higher crimes. They would attempt to increase docility, prevent a return to prior behavior, and generally improve the prisoners by means of altering their bodies and minds.
By means of poking and prodding, by means of needles and potions that burn, and tools that cut memories like paper, they'll take their subjects apart. Stick them back together, and then cut them apart again, over and over.
Bliss had been born in just such a facility. She hadn't said anything in a long time, so Ulsa spoke to fill the silence.
That's right, Guildhead. Candle Bay Imperial Prison,
Bliss said again, but this time she finished the thought.
Belongs at the bottom of the ocean.
Bliss grabbed the chains between Ulsa's manacled hands and let a trickle of her power change them. It was such a simple change that it took no effort. After all, there was no real difference between manacles locked and unlocked. The cuffs clicked open, and the mass of metal fell to the ground. One of her escorts sighed.
Guildhead, we were ordered by the Emperor himself to keep her in guild custody. That means we have to move her to a secure facility. We only need your signature.
Bliss rarely felt anything like anger, but something inside her had been scraped raw, thinking of Canatalia and their experiments. It had put her into what Nathaniel Boreas would have called a mood. She unfastened two of the silver buttons holding her coat together, reaching inside.
her fingers closed on ancient bone. She pulled the spear of Tharlos from its resting place. Foot after foot of old, yellowed bone came out of her coat until it became clear that the spear was longer than her pocket could have possibly contained, until it was longer than she was tall. It rushed out of her coat almost without her guidance, leaping into the air, where it spun in a quick circle before she reached up and caught it. The ancient spear stood 6 feet tall, with a straight shaft that flattened into a sharp, spade-like blade at the top. The weapon had been carved in the elder days by one of the Emperor's companions from the corpse of Tharlos, the Formless Legion. It took all of Bliss's willpower to keep the weapon from driving everyone else insane. Even with her restraint, the plants in the greenhouse twisted and danced as though driven by a thousand shifting winds. Her coat flapped in a wind that didn't exist, her hair blowing in the opposite direction. One of the watchmen shielded his eyes, shouting as though the sight of the bone burned him, and the other covered his ears. Ulsa shook like a sail in high wind, but she kept her eyes fixed on Bliss.
As the head of the Black Watch, I hereby decree that Ulsa Greyweather is remanded to my personal custody,
Bliss said.
If you would like to protest, file a complaint.
The two members of her guild staggered away, leaving their captive behind. The power of Tharlos wriggled under Bliss's skin, trying to change her, but she liked things the way they were. She turned to Ulsa.
Do you think they'll really file a complaint?
Ulsa struggled to speak.
No,
she said at last.
No, I don't think they will. Good. I don't like paperwork.
Bliss turned and examined the bone spear, struck with a new problem. Now that she had given the spear a taste of freedom, it would be all the more reluctant to go back to sleep. Maybe she should have let it consume the other two watchmen. They had annoyed her anyway. But they were part of her guild. They were hers. She pulled the butt of the spear off the ground, walking over to the leafless tree at the center of the greenhouse. Ulsa followed, though it must have been difficult for her to push against the power of Tharlos.
The spear is restless,
Bliss explained.
I must feed it to calm it down.
She leveled the spear of Tharlos, driving its bone point deep into the trunk of the tree. The tree shook like a struck drum. Bliss turned and walked away, pinching Ulsa's wrist between two fingers as she did and dragging the taller woman along with her.
We should stand back.
When they were far enough away, Bliss turned to watch the show. The bark was already shot through with pale purple flesh like cracks in a window. Flesh spread through the tree, bringing wood to life. The lowest branch drooped like a melting candle as it changed from a stiff bough to a limb of skin and meat. Soon all the branches were purple-white tentacles, flailing in the air like a squid trying to escape a trap. The trunk was a solid, bulbous mass of throbbing limbs, firmly rooted in the ground by its own sticky weight. Bliss clapped quietly, politely, like an audience member at the opera. There was no better show than watching reality shift before her eyes. When she stepped up to the newborn creature's trunk to retrieve her spear, the waving tentacles parted to let her pass. She pulled the sharpened bone out, leaving no wound behind. The spear of Tharlos sat easy in her hand, warm and sated. It wasn't difficult to compress it down to the size of a thigh bone and tuck the weapon back into her coat. Ulsa Greyweather stood staring at the tentacle tree, but something about her expression was off. She didn't seem disgusted enough. It was not the expression that Bliss had come to expect from someone witnessing the spear's effects. Bliss took that to mean that something else was troubling her.
Probably her son's trial,
she reasoned.
That event must have caused a good deal of stress.
What will you do with me now, Guildhead?
Ulsa asked, still looking at the tree.
The others were telling the truth. The Emperor did order me confined.
Certainly Bliss did not want to oppose the Emperor. She knew, better than most, how powerful he really was. But Bliss was not weak herself. Her experience suggested that the Emperor would overlook anything she chose to do as long as Ulsa didn't make any trouble.
You will stay with me, under my personal supervision. You will be very secure. And you may be able to help me with some investigations of my own.
She had started to hear some disturbing rumors. Navigators and their passengers had spotted children of Nakothi swimming around the Aeon. The island over the dead mother's corpse was shaking, sending unseasonable waves into the shallower islands. and more than a few sailors had reported contact with Kelerak, the soul collector. Even more troubling than the rumors were the silences. If Nakothi and Kelerak were stirring, then the other great elders should be as well. But from the tombs of Kathanikar, the desert temple of Othagor, and the ruined city over Urgnaut's corpse, she heard nothing, not a whisper. Bliss had always found stillness more disturbing than screams. But those were longer concerns. In the short term, Bliss knew that she would feel better if she could just get Ulsa to relax. Exercise was supposed to alleviate stress, but Ulsa would probably not enjoy a fencing match in her current state. Alcohol relieved stress in some, but seemed to increase it in others. Bliss couldn't take the risk. That left, to Bliss's knowledge, only companionship and sugary foods. Bliss took Ulsa's hand in her own and proposed a solution.
Let's go buy a pie from a restaurant. It is my turn to purchase.
That was only fair.
Tell me, do they accept gold coins?
Ulsa's demeanor was already more pleasant, which pleased Bliss. She had done something good today after all.
Yes, Guildhead. I expect they will.
Present day. The Eternal was waiting for them only a day's trip out from the Grey Island. Calder saw the red sails and bright alchemical flames on the ocean long before the ship actually hailed him. There was no point running. They had surely been spotted, and whenever Jarilis Teach returned on her Chimera bird, she would be able to overtake the Testament no matter where he ran. He had no choice but to confront the Guildheads dead on, which left him with several hours between spotting the Eternal and reaching her. He stared out over the port railing, thinking. He was in no hurry, so he left Dalton Foster at the wheel, their ship propelled by nothing more than the power of the wind. Andal joined him, leaning white-clad elbows on the edge.
I'm sorry we didn't get her back.
The words threatened to cut a bundle of emotion free, but Calder choked it back.
I had my chance. You went back.
Didn't matter much in the end, don't you think? The quartermaster rubbed his silver pendant.
I think we don't know yet.
Calder eyed him. Don't know what?
Many things. For instance.
Andal turned around, leaning back against the railing and staring at the center of the deck.
What are we going to do about him?
The first of their prisoners knelt tied to the mast, still wearing his torn red suit. Nabarius had spent an hour of the first night screaming about what he was going to do with their parts once he'd killed them, how they would be more useful after they died. After that hour, Calder had stuffed a foot of rope into his mouth. Now he mostly grunted and spat.
That's a good question, Calder said.
He walked over to Nabarius, pulling the wet length of rope out of the man's mouth. What do you think, Nabarius? What should we do with you? The former chronicler coughed and swallowed for a few seconds, working enough moisture into his mouth to speak. At last, he said,
Beg me for forgiveness.
A week before, Nabarius would have been cunning enough to at least lie to his captors in the hope of freedom. The heart had taken that shred of sanity from him, leaving him lost in delusion. But Calder was sure of one thing. They're not crowning that emperor. Andal walked over, circling the bound witness like a shark circling prey.
I would hope not.
Trust me, I'm the one with the crown.
It will do nothing for you, Nabarius spat. I will be remade, and you will be remade. The Empire will be torn to pieces, and from those remnants, I will create a masterpiece.
He kept on mumbling to himself as Andal dropped to his heels in front of the man, looking him in the eye.
Tell me, Nabarius, Andal said, is there any part of you left that does not bow to the dead mother?
The chronicler's raving didn't slow.
Death is not the end. Life is the end. We are all children waiting to return to the mother.
Andal nodded as if Nabarius had said something completely reasonable.
I see. If we left you on an island, what would you do?
What was the point of this test? Nabarius was clearly not in his right mind. He would give nothing but nonsensical answers, and surely Andal had to see that. But Calder said nothing, trusting his second in command. Nabarius grinned.
I would call to the dead mother for claws and wings. I would fly to you, and I would tear out your heart.
He spat in Andal's face. Andal's expression didn't change.
He nodded again, wiping his cheek with the back of his hand. There's no cure for what ails him, Calder said at last. They could hand him over to Cheska. She would make sure that Nabarius got back to his family, or to a mental facility equipped to deal with him, or to an abandoned island. Calder wasn't particularly bothered. Evidently, Andal disagreed.
There's one, he said.
He pulled out his pistol and shot Nabarius in the forehead. The gunshot floated over the deck like a ghost as the chronicler's body slowly slid sideways. Andal gripped the man by his suit, heaving him up and carrying him to the railing. A second later, a splash indicated that Nabarius had made his way to the Aeon. Calder's shock made him feel like he was the one who had just taken a bullet to the head. He'd seen men die before, but he didn't execute people. And for Andal, of all people, to have done it, he was having trouble adjusting his thoughts.
Too many chances we couldn't take,
Andal explained, wiping down his gun with a handkerchief before he tossed the weapon up to the gunner.
Reload that for me, Foster.
Dalton Foster desperately snatched the gun out of the air.
Don't go throwing guns around, loaded or not, don't do it.
He glanced over at Calder, then added,
But good job with the dead weight. Would have saved us some trouble to put a bullet in his crown 3 weeks ago.
Calder didn't bother to respond. He had more important things to deal with. He was the one who had to explain to the guildheads what had happened to Nabarius, not Foster, and he would have to do it today, which meant he had to wear that same itchy jacket again. He lifted the dark blue jacket, staring at it. It was rough, tight, and it looked just as uncomfortable as it felt. Seized by a sudden inspiration, he tossed the jacket after Nabarius. The chronicler was dead, and Calder couldn't tell if he felt more disturbed or relieved. They had a consultant prisoner in the hold, they still hadn't gotten Jerry back, and Urziah was gone. His crew was down to Andal, Foster, Paddle, and himself. Even considering his control over the vessel, he was short-handed. It was time to stop holding his cards back and put everything on the table. He marched into the main cabin of the Eternal without a jacket, carrying with him a wooden case and an all but empty sack. The bandages over his chest would be visible through the shirt, and he still walked with a limp, but he thought the injuries made him look rugged and battle-scarred. The only wound he wanted to hide was Kelerak's burn on his right arm, which was covered by his sleeve. No telling how Bliss would react to that. General Teach sat at the far end of the table, her red and black plated arms crossed. She had returned only minutes after he'd set foot on deck, and it had taken all of his and Captain Bennett's combined persuasive power to prevent her from killing him on the spot. Cheska Bennett was no longer dressed for a ball. Her hair was tied back with a bandana, she wore clothes almost identical to Calder's own, and she leaned back against the wall, propping her boots up on the table. She faced Calder wearing a cocky grin, evidently more amused than upset by his actions. And then there was Bliss, alone at the other end of the table. She looked the same as she always had, staring at a tiny butterfly of blown glass as though she expected it would attack at any second. His mother was conspicuously absent, but Bliss had explained that Ulsa was somewhere else. He didn't expect any more detail. Also missing was the head of the Magisters, Mackendy Maxius. His guild was stretched thin as it was, and he had decided his skills were of more use in the capital than floating in an unmarked stretch of the Aeon. Calder entered on his own, but he didn't sit. Before Cheska could welcome him or anyone else could say a word, he bowed to Gerilis Teach.
General Teach, I apologize once again for the unfortunate circumstances of our last meeting.
What about the meeting before that?
Teach asked, eyes cold.
I apologize for the unfortunate circumstances surrounding each and every one of our meetings, and I hope we can be more friendly in the future.
He turned to Bliss. Guildhead, it's a pleasure to see you again. Thank you for your recent support. Teach gripped the table at the mention of Bliss's support, but Bliss only nodded vaguely, still fixated on the butterfly. It slid slightly as the ship bobbed, and the guildhead jumped in fright. At last, he nodded to Captain Bennett.
Cheska, you looked better last time.
If anything, her grin widened.
Carve it in your memory, Captain. You'll never see its like again as long as you live.
Calder placed the wooden case on the tabletop, setting the sack next to it. Before you make a decision regarding me and my crew, I would like to submit a few facts for your consideration. First, Nabarius Claiborne is dead.
General Teach's hostile intent scorched him from across the table. Thanks to the sword she wore, he physically shuddered. At this distance, it was entirely possible that she could kill him just by wishing hard enough.
"Details?" she demanded.
"It was an unavoidable casualty of battle," he said smoothly. Nabarius' mind was eroded completely by the heart of Nakothi. Before he died, he said nothing without ranting about death and rebirth. Bliss sighed.
"He should not have tried to awaken it on his own. It was dangerous enough sleeping, but when it... Hey, get back here!"
The butterfly slid across the table, and she used her hand to stop it before it fell to the deck and shattered. Cheska shut her eyes and let her head flop back against the back of her chair.
"There go months of planning, and so much money. Do you know how much I invested in him?"
Calder cleared his throat. "I may be able to help with that." He flipped open the case, revealing rows of white candles. Teach nodded slowly, and Cheska opened her eyes a crack. When she saw what he'd revealed, she whistled and pulled her legs off the table. He claimed that all the riches of the Imperial Palace and all the details of the accounts were somewhere in here, Calder said. If a reader, say me for instance, burns them, we should be able to learn something. At least we can get your investment back, Cheska.
I should hope so,
she said, but she sounded much more hopeful than before.
That doesn't address our most important concern, Teach said irritably. We still have no candidate for the throne. If we are forced to anoint Nathaniel Boreas the leader of the Aurelian Empire, I just might kill him myself.
Not if I get to him first,
Bliss whispered to the butterfly. Just so I'm clear, Calder began. What were the qualities you were looking for in our new emperor? Cheska and Teach exchanged glances.
He should be a powerful reader,
Teach began.
Well connected,
Cheska continued.
We would prefer a man. If Estia Six were willing to sit on the throne, perhaps the people would accept an empress. But without her, there's only so much change they can take at one time.
Rich, Cheska added.
He has to be well-educated and dignified, Teach said. And of course, I have to approve. I'm still stuck on Rich. He must be someone the people can approve. The public needs stability, now more than ever.
Bliss finally looked up, adding,
I'd like it if he were sane. But I will work with what I can get.
To each of their points, Calder nodded. When they were finished, he placed one hand on the case of Chronicler's candles and one on the sack to his left. With all that in mind, I would like to propose a new candidate. Pinching the burlap sack between two fingers, he picked it up. The Emperor's crown tumbled out, rolling slightly as it landed on the table. Geralis Teach's breath caught, and she unconsciously reached a hand out. Cheska gave a low whistle. Bliss tilted her head, interested.
Where did you get that?
Teach whispered, but Calder ignored her. She probably wouldn't appreciate the story anyway. I like to think of myself as a powerful reader. I am reasonably well-educated, and I can be dignified when I put my mind to it. Hopefully, he patted the candles, I will be coming into some money soon. I'm reasonably sane. If you three approve, that would qualify me as well-connected. And I assure you that I am indeed a man. Cheska pounded a fist on the table.
Prove it!
Teach silenced her with a glare. Calder finally let his true feelings bleed into his voice, the ambition he'd hidden for years. And I am not immortal. I don't need to be bound to the heart or to anything else. Let me live a normal span of years and then die. A regular, mortal, human ruler who will be replaced by an heir after my death. Which hopefully won't give the great elders enough time to turn me into a puppet. He picked up the golden crown and placed it on his head, striking a pose. So, what do you think? There was an instant of quiet before Cheska burst out laughing. Bliss raised her eyes to him.
Is it appropriate to call you by title, or should I keep using your name?
Only Geralis Teach seemed to object, scowling at the sight of him wearing the crown.
More than anything, we need a willing person to sit on the throne. As far as that goes, you qualify.
His hopes soared. Part of him had wondered if she would take his head off for making the attempt.
But you are quite possibly the worst candidate when it comes to patching relations with the other guilds. The consultants are after you as we speak. How will you handle them?
Calder tried to project absolute confidence and an air of mystery. In fact, I've already taken steps. Trust me. I have held one card in reserve. When he climbed up the ladder and onto the Testament's deck, No one was at the wheel. Andal was nowhere to be seen, and a pile of ropes sat at the base of the mast. Foster hurried up to him, blood running down into his beard from a split lip. The gunner spoke only two words.
She's loose!
Now that you've finished this leg of the journey, you may be wondering where to go next. Here's a quick tip from the author. Of Sea and Shadow is written in parallel to its companion novel, Of Shadow and Sea. But now that you've finished Of Sea and Shadow, you face a terrible dilemma that demands a heroic decision to be made by you, the listener. Will you choose to move on and find out what happens to Calder next? Not a bad choice. If you sail that direction, you should seek out Of Dawn and Darkness, which tells the next step of Calder's journey. However, there is an alternative route you might find intriguing. You could choose to listen to a parallel version of the story you just heard, told from the perspective of Shera, the consultant assassin. If that piques your curiosity, you can immediately continue to Of Shadow and Sea for Shera's story. If you choose to jump ship for Shera's perspective, this is a glimpse of the road ahead. The Consultants Guild has served the Aurelian Empire for over 1,000 years, working in the darkness to hunt dissension and eliminate traitors. Now, the Emperor is dead. For Shera, an assassin in the employ of the Consultants, the Emperor's death is the beginning of a nightmare. Powerful forces hunt the heart of Nekothi, a cursed object that can raise a second Emperor, and corrupt him in the process. But some desire power at any cost. The Guild of Navigators, an infamous collection of swindlers and pirates, has been paid a fortune to secure the heart. Their only lord is greed, their only loyalty to gold, and they would sell the Empire's freedom for the promise of a quick coin. In the shadows, a woman works to set the world free. On the seas, a man seeks to raise a lunatic to lord over mankind. There is no wrong way to listen to the 6 novels in this series. One path is more linear, ordered together for those of you who prefer a more methodical approach. The other path jumps from one side to the other and is intended for those of you who want to discover all the secrets and meet all the characters as soon as possible. Be assured of this, though. Whichever method you choose, the books will still add up to one complete adventure. So, which will it be? Of Dawn and Darkness to continue sailing with Calder, or Of Shadow and Sea to creep through the shadows with Shera? Either way, a fresh journey awaits you.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Sea and Shadow, written by Will White, performed by Travis Baldry. Executive producers Ryan McGavin and Mike Charzik. Copyright 2014 by Hidden Gnome Publishing. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.